Speaking of stupid, to meet the Biden Green New Deal targets, America has to get this. America has to stop eating meat, stop eating poultry, fish, seafood, eggs, dairy, and animal-based fats. Okay, you got that?
Yeah, I got that. It's all lies. I expect no less.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Fox News.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. In Concord, New Hampshire on WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. Seattle's KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF, amongst other fine terrestrial stations. And yes, we are also streaming coast to coast and around the globe on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. We are going to talk about progressive policy with my guest momentarily and the need for Democrats to figure out that progressive policy on its own is not enough. That like Republicans, Democrats need to figure out how to include structural reforms that actually shift political power, in this case toward progressives, that needs to be included as well in their policies, just as Republicans do so expertly when they use policy to advantage right-wingism. Deepak Bhargava, who's really good on this stuff, will join me momentarily to explain what that all actually means. But before we get to the progressive policy wonkery, a bit of red meat here, quite literally, that we will be also covering in today's Green News Report with Desi Doyen later in the show. Hi,
yep.
Des.
Hi.
That I know people have been talking about, but Desi, you caught one aspect of this that I just want to highlight by way of showing how unimaginably stupid these people are and how they are still poisoning the minds of Americans and, of course, the body politic itself, in order to help ensure that nothing actually improves or nothing actually gets done in this country if they have their way. They are built for obstruction. There's an entire industry built for obstruction, something, again, that Democrats and progressives should be learning from. So over the weekend, Fox so-called News picked up this story from this British tabloid, Daily Mail, citing an academic study from the University of Michigan that looked a year ago, and again, before Biden was even in office, it looked at the various effects on greenhouse gas emissions that we would see if Americans limited their intake of meat and other animal products, finding that, among other things, cutting meat consumption by 90% would, in fact, reduce emissions to levels that I think on their own would meet the level that scientists say is needed to avoid the worst effects of global warming. Is that how you understand this study
as
well?
Yes. It's all one right. way, one method that could be enacted in some fashion.
Right. So if we all wanted to give up 90% of the meat we eat, that might take care of global warming. All right. Anyway, Fox News picks up this Daily Mail story, the British tabloid story that was reporting on this academic study. They picked it up and they reported it as if it was Biden's climate plan, which, by the way, I don't believe he's actually introduced.
No.
And that Americans, nonetheless, are going to have to now stop eating any more than 4 pounds of meat per year, according to the meat Nazis in the Biden administration.
That's which don't exist.
Thing, which don't exist. So it was naturally, it was picked up and you know, they beat up on this idea across all of the Fox shows all weekend long. Here is a, so to speak, taste.
Say goodbye to your burgers if you want to sign up for the Biden climate agenda. That's the finding of one study. They can't have a steak on the grill or a hamburger on the grill July 4th.
Americans would have to cut red meat consumption by a whopping 90%. That means only one burger a month.
Yes, that's what it means. Except it's all nonsense. And, you know, unfortunately, what happens on Fox does not just stay on Fox. As Media Matters notes today, right-wing politicians and commentators have worked themselves into a frothy rage over an imaginary government-imposed cap on the amount of meat that Americans are now allowed to eat in a given year. Not gonna happen in Texas, tweeted Republican Governor Greg Abbott. Congresswoman Lauren Boebert demanded that Biden stay out of her kitchen. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene called Joe Biden the Hamburglar. Donald Trump, you like that one, do you? Donald Trump Jr. wrote, quote, I'm pretty sure I ate 4 pounds of red meat yesterday. That's going to be a hard no from me. Well, I'm glad we got the hard no from Don Jr. I guess that's it then. Anyway, my favorite was actually Larry Kudlow, who went from being a business guy on CNBC to becoming Donald Trump's top White House economic advisor, this guy, which also may explain a thing or two. And then he went back through, of course, the Wingnut Welfare revolving door to have his own show again now on business on Fox, in which he said this weekend,
no burgers on July 4th. No steaks on the Barbie. I'm sure middle America is just going to love that. Can you grill those Brussels sprouts? So get ready. You can throw back a plant-based beer with your grilled Brussels sprouts and wave your American flag. Call it July 4th Green.
Okay, so first, Larry, yes, you can grill those Brussels sprouts. They are delicious. So I'm not even sure what he meant by that part. But Des, it was you actually pointed out you had thoughts on the beer aspect of Kudlow's rant there.
All beer is plant-based. So you can't have any other kind of beer other than plant-based beer.
What is he talking about?
Well, he's obviously trying to throw out, no pun intended, red meat to Fox News' base, who won't notice the major intellectual dishonesty of calling it your plant-based beer.
Oh, they're going to be outraged by that. Oh, great. Now we have to drink plant-based beer.
And as a business guy, I'm kind of shocked. I should not be shocked when it's Larry Kudlow because he says insane things all the time. But the stocks of plant-based food companies like Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat are skyrocketing.
Yeah, through the roof.
Yeah.
So even if you did have to have plant-based burgers, which might have made sense in that rant versus plant-based beer, that would be good for business. And of course, we need to underscore none of this is actually
this is
real.
True. Biden has put absolutely zero, nothing, zip, no personal consumption or individual action restrictions in any of his climate plans.
And what he was saying there was not a hot take on an opinion show, talking about plant-based beer. It wasn't he didn't misspeak. He, I guess, or his writers actually wrote that for him. It was a written monologue. Plant-based beer. It's all plant-based. Anyway, that's just a reminder of where right-wingers get their news. And that is the most respectable place, by the way, that they get their news. It's better than Newsmax or OAN, who are much more insane. And these are the people that Joe Biden says he'd like to work with to create policy, to, save the country and the economy after COVID, not to mention save the world from our climate emergency. Good frickin' luck, Joe. You know, and again, it's not right wing. It's not just, you know, far right fringe people. These are elected officials. But rather than try to convince those people to come along, as my guest will argue in a minute, what if we expand the base of people who support progressive policy? Rather than trying to win over these brainwashed clucks who actually buy what they are hearing on Fox and Friends, hook, line, and sinker. And yes, as I say, it's actually top elected officials in the Republican Party. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, congresswomen, Lauren Boebert, and the rest of these clowns who only completely get their information from Fox News. Well, it doesn't seem like Joe Biden is falling for it. It does seem like he's getting the message. Today, according to the White House, President Joe Biden is issuing an executive order raising the minimum wage paid by federal contractors to $15 an hour. End of story. That's a lot of people who work for the government or as contractors for companies that are contracted by the government who are likely going to be very happy because they are getting a raise. A big one. The new minimum raises the hourly wage minimum of currently $10.95 per hour that was set under an order by former President Barack Obama back in 2014. It raises the rate, in fact, almost 50%. That's a huge boost in income to a lot of federal workers. Moreover, Biden's order, which will also require that the new minimum wage rise with inflation.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so that's a big thing, too. So he doesn't have to keep raising it every year, but it's going to go up as inflation goes up, at least until a Republican president comes in and stops all of that. The executive order, quote, ensures that hundreds of thousands of workers no longer have to work full time and still live in poverty. It will improve the economic security of families and make progress toward reversing decades of income inequality, the White House said. They have argued that the increase will not lead to significant job losses and that it was unlikely to cost taxpayers more money. Why? Well, because money like that for low-wage workers goes immediately back into the economy for the most part and then back to the government as part of tax revenue. The White House has also said that the higher wage would lead to greater productivity and lower turnover in these jobs. That also actually saves the government money. This development is now the latest step in efforts by the Biden administration to tackle labor issues after earlier steps to reverse Trump-era rules that had weakened worker protections. All of which, I expect, my guess, will explain momentarily, redounds to the benefit of Democrats. It is good policy, but it is also smart politics at the same time. And Democrats need to do much, much more of that to catch up with the savage industry of lies and misinformation that goes out to Americans, while gutting progressive institutions and restricting access for Democrats to the ballot box, that GOP policies are always very careful to do in order to grow its share of the electorate. During his campaign, Biden painted himself as an ally to strengthening unions, and early on in his administration, he sought to increase the minimum wage nationally for everyone to $15 an hour. In the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill, the American Rescue Plan, that the Senate parliamentarian ultimately ruled could not be included, that $15 an hour provision couldn't be included under Senate rules, which dictate the type of measures that can be included in a budget reconciliation bill, which is exempt from filibusters, allowing passage by a simple majority vote. Anyway, the wingnut media is not the only way in which Republicans have spent years creating an unlevel playing field that Democrats need to figure out how to respond to. with things like, oh, the minimum wage. Who gave that to you? We did, the Democrats. As we noted in our previous broadcast, the new 2020 U.S. Census numbers are beginning to come in now, and there will be a number of U.S. House seat pickups by Republican-leaning states like Texas and Florida and North Carolina, and losses of seats in Democratic-leaning states like Illinois, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. But there are also some House seat pickups in states like Colorado and Oregon, which tend to lean Democratic these days. The real effect of this decennial shuffle in House seats will come when those states are redistricted to accommodate the new seats or to reduce districts in states that are losing a seat. As we noted on our show yesterday, as this reshuffling of the congressional map moves seats from blue states to red ones, Republicans will have a clear, immediate advantage, at least in several states, in that the party has given themselves complete control over drawing the congressional maps in states like Texas and Florida and North Carolina, states that are together adding four seats just in those three states for theoretically for Republicans. By way of contrast, however, Democrats control the process in Oregon, but Democratic lawmakers there have agreed to give Republicans an equal say when it comes to redistricting, that in exchange for a commitment for the Republicans to stop blocking bills. In Democratic Colorado, a nonpartisan commission will draw the lines, meaning the party will not have total control in any single expanding state's redistricting. It's more fair. It is more small d Democratic, but it's also a matter of Democrats unilaterally disarming against Republicans who decidedly do not play by such niceties. Republicans, unlike Democrats in too many cases, are keenly aware of the political power that they bake into the policy agenda that they pass. While Democrats all too often focus on the policy itself, even if it comes at a cost to their political ambitions and needs. So can that be changed? Well, my guest Deepak Bhargava says it absolutely can be, and in fact, it must be. He joins us next to explain how. I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to the Bradcast. Cheers. Please have a plant-based beer on me. Hey, this is Brad. If you haven't noticed by now, it's no easy feat finding facts, real facts, not alternative facts, over your public airwaves. We try to bring you real facts, truth, and clarity without fear or favor each and every day on the Bradcast. But we need your help to do it, and that help is needed more now than ever. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
This is how we do it. Mm-hmm. This is how we do it.
Well, this is how we should do it. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Writing last month at the American Prospect, and I should note, by the way, this was before passage of Joe Biden and the Democrats' emergency one-year $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan for COVID relief and stimulus. And if I'm not mistaken, prior to the introduction of Joe Biden's $2.25 trillion plan for infrastructure, jobs, and climate resiliency called the American Jobs Plan. And even a month or two before Biden would reach his first 100 days mark coming up this week. So at the American Prospect at that point, Deepak Bhargava and Dorian T. Warren discussed what they described and define as the progressive multiplier effect when it comes to policy agendas via both legislation and executive actions by the president, specifically as a way for Democrats to defeat Trumpism in the months and years ahead. They ask, how can Democrats in Washington address the multiple crises facing our nation while also confronting an increasingly radical and often explicitly anti-democratic, that small d democratic, opposition party? Political strategists perhaps inevitably focus on how to change the hearts and minds of millions of devoted Trump supporters. But there's another approach to building a lasting, governing, pro-democracy majority there, right? One that is more likely to succeed in the short term. Paradoxically, to defeat Trumpism, Democrats and progressive groups should look to an unexpected source for strategic insight. That would be the conservative movement. They write, "We tend to forget that conservatives recently faced a significant dilemma after Obama's 2008 election, facing off against seemingly formidable majorities of people of color and progressive whites, implacably opposed to their agenda, and ongoing demographic change, making the task of winning governing power back even harder." And yes, I will remind you here that when Barack Obama took office in 2008, he not only had a majority in the U.S. House, Democrats did, they also had nearly filibuster-proof majority in the U.S. Senate. And in fact, an actual filibuster-proof majority eventually after the drawn-out legal challenge to Al Franken's senatorial victory in Minnesota. But that filibuster-proof Senate only lasted for a month or so prior to the death of Senator Ted Kennedy. In any event, Democrats had formidable majorities indeed, unlike the very narrow majorities in both houses of Congress right now. And yet, 8 years later, Republicans had taken back control of the White House and both chambers of Congress. Bhargava and Warren go on to argue at the prospect that Republicans, who were deep in the minority at the time, did not respond to this challenge by trying to win over their opponents. Instead, conservative political activists and elected officials became extraordinarily adept at passing policies that shift political power and opportunities by changing the deep math of politics. Democrats should, of course, govern with the aim of solving the array of policy problems our country faces, they contend. But they should also learn, they write, from the most successful power shifts conservatives have engineered. In particular, Democrats should pursue policies that break power by eroding the sources of strength of the Trump coalition and bolster power by empowering workers, people of color, women, immigrants, both at the ballot box and in communities and workplaces. So what does that mean exactly? Well, Bhargava and Warren note that a core part of so-called conservative strategy has been explicitly political, including measures to unfairly restrict access to voting for people of color and young people and to reduce the value of their votes through gerrymandering. And also that conservatives have reshaped power relationships outside of the political arena in ways that have profound but less widely understood downstream political consequences. So are Bhargava and Warren at the prospect calling for similarly ruthless and even small d undemocratic practices by the Democrats now in power, as we see from Republicans when they are in power? I don't know. But as Joe Biden has offered a surprisingly progressive agenda to date and seems to have plans to continue in that general direction, as long as progressives continue to push him to do so, are progressive policies on their own enough to continue to win over the electorate? Or do they need to institute policies that also helped to shift political power in their favor? Let's find out. Joining us now is one of the two co-authors of the American Prospect piece on this. Deepak Bhargava is a distinguished lecturer of urban studies at City University of New York and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He is also the co-editor of the new book out today, as luck would have it, called Immigration Matters, Movements, Visions, and Strategies for a Progressive Future. Now, there's an idea. Deepak Bhargava, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Brad, it's great to be with you. Thanks.
First, congratulations on the new book. We will talk about it a bit, I'm sure, as I suspect much of it actually plays into what we may be talking about here today. But first, and before we discuss what you argue should be the progressive approach moving forward to not only enact progressive policies, but also increase progressive political power in the bargain. And also, if you are seeing evidence of that to date in the first 100 days of Biden's tenure, since you and Dorian Warren wrote the article, please explain for us a bit more specifically what you mean by the so-called conservative, I call them Republican or right wing, anything but conservative, but the conservative policies that entrench political power, which Democrats need to respond to in their own way, beginning as you do with labor policy, for example, and how Republicans have now crafted federal labor policy to their political advantage.
Yeah, well, it's really important to understand that when right-wing governments take hold, when the Republicans take power, they, of course, care about their policy agenda, like tax cuts and deregulation.
Mm-hmm.
But they start with the premise that in order to get all that done, they have to take the knees out from under their opposition.
Mm.
So their first order of business, even though they often don't run on these issues because they are manifestly unpopular, their very first orders of business are typically to weaken unions. That's often number one. Number two is to weaken voting rights, targeting people of color, especially and young voters who lean Democratic. And number three is to change the rules of the political game through gerrymandering and other means so that they are making an electorate that is more favorable to them.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing these things, by passing these things first, conservatives and Republicans create a situation where they have more power in the next legislative session and the one after that to do more and more conservative policy, to take the state or the country in a more extreme direction. That's the heart of the conservative playbook in America, and it has worked. After Obama's election 2008 and 2010, Republicans swept state houses around the country. They passed anti-union bills everywhere. They passed anti-voting bills, voting restriction bills everywhere. And that has brought us to our current political impasse.
And you would argue that this is not just, this is not an accident, but this is sort of baked into the cake for Republican policy, that they look for their policy agenda and how to buttress that with their political agenda as part of that same policy.
Yeah, there's a whole network of state-based think tanks funded by the Koch brothers, the right-wing billionaires, that have been kind of like a factory for these anti-union, anti-democratic, small-d democratic bills. And so you see the same legislation introduced in place after place after place. It's happening now, of course, with respect to voter suppression. But they have an industry that's really devoted to the premise that you use governing power to get more power.
You argue at the prospect, beyond unions, conservatives have also sought to cripple other organizational bases of progressive power, including reproductive health providers, community organizing groups, as well as legal service associations representing low-income constituencies. And on the other side of the coin, they increase the power with massive spending on constituencies like law enforcement and, really, the military-industrial complex since 9/11, which too often, I would add, it seems Democrats tend to join them in. How have those actions increased right-wing Republican political power as you see it by funding law enforcement and the military-industrial complex and so forth?
Yeah, this is very poorly understood, I think, by the American public. But since 2001, there has been a massive increase in federal expenditures on the national security state, including but not limited to immigration, for other forms of law enforcement, et cetera. That funding has gone in two directions. It's gone to private corporations that have bankrolled Republican candidates and causes. So they've essentially been feeding the corporate, the most conservative elements of the corporate class. So this is firms that do incarceration and immigrant detention and surveillance of all of us mm-hmm. all the time through big data, Palantir and groups like that. And then they've created a massive workforce, people whose everyday job is law enforcement, detention, incarceration. And those groups of workers are the most conservative. They're basically creating their own constituency of voters. Mm-hmm. So the problem has been that Democrats, instead of opposing those increases in law enforcement spending, have tended to go along with them. So it hasn't varied much under Democrats versus Republicans. And that's one of the key things that's got to change.
Yeah, I've noticed since we've talked about it before, since 9/11 and all of this money that is flowing out to these defense contractors who in turn then make huge donations to Republicans, the Republican Party. It's as if that money that the taxpayers are giving to those companies come back to fund Republican campaigns. The net result of these conservative strategies, you write, has been to maximize the potential political power of right-wing constituencies and dilute the influence of progressive ones. Democrats should learn from each of these design principles, you argue. So does that mean, how does that work out? Does that mean attacking and destroying GOP political power bases and enacting measures to decrease the voting power and access to polls by Republicans? That's not what you're talking about, is it?
No. So this is the crucial distinction. I do want Democrats to be ruthless, but I want them to be ruthless about expanding democracy. Mm-hmm. So the Republicans have been ruthless about restricting democracy, mm-hmm. democracy at the workplace, meaning unions, democracy at the polls, meaning voting rights. I want the Democratic Party to be ruthless about expanding everybody's participation. That means Republicans too, but mm-hmm. making it easier to participate, easier to join a union, easier to vote, easier to participate in all kinds of ways in civil society. So this is the crucial difference. Yes, it will redound to Democrats' favor, I think, and progressives' favor if more people are able to be part of our democracy. But the underlying agenda here is to expand small-d democracy in America. And that's why the two strategies don't have any equivalence. You know, FDR mm-hmm. did this during the New Deal, instituted a set of policies that expanded workers' rights to organize. Lyndon Johnson did this in the 1960s with the Civil Rights Act, particularly in the Voting mm-hmm. Rights Act. This can be done again, and it is the secret sauce. It is the genius of how to do progressive governance in America. There's no way to do it without expanding democracy.
And you go on to describe then what a democratic agenda might look like in this regard that is both, quote, informed by conservative successes and sober about the challenge to democracy that we face, noting there are dozens of legislative and administrative actions, some high profile, requiring legislation, others more technical, requiring only executive action across a broad set of issues which would alter relations of power and strengthen democracy. You go on to detail three such examples. And if we can just walk through those, beginning with the first one, to pursue measures that make the electorate in America look more like the country's population. What does that mean exactly, and how do Democrats need to approach that?
Yeah, I mean, the starting point here is that the people who vote in America tend to be wealthier and whiter than the population of the country. Mm-hmm. We can close that gap by making it easier to vote. So that's H.R. 1, the For the People Act, mm-hmm. the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, very clear, straightforward ways to expand the franchise. Mm-hmm. There are 9 million people who right now are legal permanent residents with green cards who could become citizens if we aggressively did outreach, lowered the prohibitive fees, undid all the barriers Trump created. 9 million new people by 2022 could be voting, and as it happens, the vast majority of those will turn out to be Democrats. Mm-hmm. There are 11 million people who could be legalized and put on a path to citizenship. There are so many things that Democrats could do, that some of which require legislation, some of which don't, that would make the electorate in America look like the country. And to me, that is actually job number one. That's the single most important thing to expand our democracy that Democrats can do while they have power.
Well, of course, you say Democrats can do. There's only so much at this point the Democrats actually can do unless they can convince Joe Manchin and a few others to get rid of the filibuster, which leaves us then with executive actions. And you sort of mixed up, I think, some legislative actions and some executive actions. What specifically on the presumption that Joe Manchin is not going to come around anytime soon to allow us to pass the For the People Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and so forth? What is it that President Biden could do executively that the administration could do to increase the electorate? You mentioned 9 million people with green cards at this point. Does the president have the power to give them voting power?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Trump administration was hugely strategic in making it much, much harder for people to become citizens and vote.
Mm-hmm.
They increased fees. They made the questions harder. They lengthened the time you had to wait. They did everything they could to throw roadblocks in the way. The Biden administration could lower the fees. It could do massive outreach. It could make the test take it back to what it used to be so that, I mean, I'm not sure you or I would be able to pass the citizenship test as it's written today.
Right.
All these basic things, with a massive outreach campaign, organizing campaign to say, we want you to be part, a full part of American democracy, it would result in larger than the margin of victory in the presidential race of number of people who'd be naturalized in places like Pennsylvania, not somewhere you think of as a high immigrant state, but actually has lots of legal permanent residents who could become naturalized. So this is like an urgent measure. Because it can, you can, it can take, if you do this well, a year to 18 months to get somebody through the process. We can do it maybe a little faster, but it's an example of how a determined effort to change the electorate and expand democracy can be done without Congress.
And it's something that, frankly, I hadn't even understood could be done. Do you get the sense, Deepak Bhargava, that the administration, that Joe Biden understands this aspect? I mean, that's substantial. 9 million new voters that could be added in time for 2022. Do you get any sense that the administration understands that and that they are taking action in this regard?
They are aware of it. You know, and I should say, by the way, newly naturalized citizens vote at higher rates than the rest of us do, who've been citizens for a while.
Right.
The thing that they're confronting is they basically face an entire bureaucracy that has been implanted with Trump appointees, and it's a very, the Department of Homeland Security is about the most hostile, anti-democratic workforce in America, and it's vast and sprawling. So they're going to have to break that down. But in general, I mean, I think the Biden administration has been more progressive than many of us have expected on many things. They have a lot of damage to undo. I do think they need to be pushed to be more focused on things like this that would have lasting consequences for our democracy and our ability to resist authoritarianism, which is not gone. The authoritarian threat in America is far from over. So I think they need to be pushed to prioritize it more than they are.
Indeed. Which leads us into your second point here on this, that Democrats could dramatically alter budgetary priorities for enforcement of policing and immigration, which, as you explained, currently dwarfs funding for things like civil rights enforcement and workers' rights and prosecuting wealthy tax cheats. I know that the Biden administration is now looking to radically increase the budget for enforcement by the IRS to catch tax cheats, at least. But how does that work toward the political power benefit of progressives, as you see it?
Yeah, well, you know, enforcement, we make a decision with our dollars about what laws we really enforce in the country. It's a values question. And right now, we have basically decided that enforcing laws related to immigration and criminal justice is our highest priority as a nation. Now, from a value standpoint, there are hundreds of billions of dollars that aren't paid to the federal government that are owed that are arguably much more consequential, but we spend a tiny fraction on it. The fact that we don't enforce those laws, or that we don't enforce laws on wage theft on employers, et cetera. The net effect of that is to create unregulated, untrammeled corporate power that expresses itself in domination in the workplace, but it also expresses itself in corporate campaign contributions and political power. Conversely, there's a ton of good social science research that shows that all this money we spend on enforcing punitive laws against black and brown people, it depresses participation. People vote less when they feel like the state, the government, is their enemy. And this is a long-standing problem. So simply reversing the balance on that enforcement or even tilting it more in the right direction would have a huge impact on Democratic participation.
Very interesting. Third, you note the Democrats could make it easier for workers to join unions and civil society groups. Now, Democrats have been pushing hard, really, with the rather aggressive urging of Joe Biden, which is nice to see, to move the Protect the Right to Organize or PRO Act forward in Congress. That measure would counter anti-union states and their so-called right to work laws, which actually undercut collective bargaining for workers. Is that the sort of measure that you are calling for in support of unions? And if so, once again, how much of it can be done without actual legislation? Because short of killing the legislative filibuster, it seems unlikely that 10 Republicans are going to come on board to support a, you know, to support labor unions to pass the PRO Act.
The PRO Act is absolutely essential. It would make an enormous difference in addressing all of the abuses by corporations that prevent workers from exercising their voice. You know, a vast majority of Americans say they would like to be part of a union, but only 11% of Americans are. Why is that? It's because corporations prevent people using outrageous tactics from doing so. The PRO Act would address that, and I'm not ready to give up on the filibuster. I think the future of our democracy may well turn on voting rights, the PRO Act, things like that, and I think there is going to have to be a kind of reckoning in the Democratic Party about the risks we face if that doesn't happen. That having been said, there are additional things that the Biden administration could do to strengthen unions. So, for example, unions can be supported, funded, to do outreach to inform unemployed workers about their benefits. This is what happens in Europe. So unemployed workers don't just leave their unions and disappear. They stay connected as a form of political engagement, of getting benefits. And that makes a huge difference in their political participation. Same thing could be done with other benefits programs and stimulus checks that the Biden administration is putting out there. A big navigators program that connected beneficiaries to civil society and union organizations can make a huge difference in expanding democracy in this country.
Would you also expect to see, similarly, a huge difference in the passage of something like the Biden's American Jobs Bill with all of this infrastructure money that will go to, theoretically, union contracts? And I guess to some extent, he'll be able to decide if these are federal contracts, you know, what the rate may be. We mentioned earlier that he's, you know, requiring a $15 minimum wage for federal contractors and so forth. Is that the sort of bill? That one looks like it could pass through the reconciliation process. Is that the kind of bill that actually has the effect that you're talking about as a progressive multiplier when all of these new union jobs spring up all over the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is a brilliant and not fully appreciated enough aspect of the Biden infrastructure plan that the infrastructure, the green infrastructure, and also the care infrastructure, the home care jobs that would be supported by this bill, that the way the bill is shaped, it would direct massive amounts of federal money to those sectors and industries and create labor standards that would make it more likely that people would join and be part of unions. And that could be a huge spur to worker organizing in this country. So I'm really, really high on that that bill and those provisions. I think it can make an enormous difference in worker voice in the country.
And I think there's a there is the idea of, and I you talk about this as well in your article at the American Prospect. You say too many liberals seem to think that good ideas sell themselves and that the political terrain is far more conducive to their agenda than it actually is, and that they rarely spend political capital on both selling their ideas to the public and, I would add, making sure that the public understands who brought these policies to them, you know, like the $1,400 individual checks and the child tax credits and the $15 an hour now for federal workers. You know, one thing that Donald Trump, a lot of folks, you know, made fun of him about was he got his name on those COVID stimulus checks he was in office. Should Joe Biden have done the same thing on the checks that he sent out under the American Rescue Plan? And are Democrats figuring out they not only need to move these policies forward, but let the public know at the ground level who is responsible for bringing them this project or that job or that individual check and so forth?
Yeah, this is a huge area where Democrats need to improve. And the Biden administration is improving significantly over the Obama years. In the Obama years, their tax cut for the middle class in the American Recovery Act was actually designed to be quote-unquote submerged, meaning it was designed so that the beneficiaries didn't know they got a tax cut.
I know.
That was the idea, right. And they succeeded.
Why? What were they thinking?
They were thinking, if you don't know that you got a tax cut, you'll be more likely to spend the extra money you get than if you think, oh, I got a tax cut, I'll save it.
So
it was kind of an economist run wild idea.
Yeah.
So this time, there is much more attention to making the policies, you know, so-called legible, meaning you can understand that there is a benefit that is coming to you. I still think there's much more that can be done. As I said, I'm pushing hard, and I think we should all be pushing hard for really aggressive outreach with human beings who go door-to-door and online saying to people, you know, this thing passed. Here's why it passed. You need to do X, Y, and Z to sign up, because there are lots of people who don't claim the benefits because they don't know about them. I think we need a kind of army of people doing that work this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Biden administration needs to make sure the bill they just passed is implemented super well. And there's a lot of naughty provisions in that. The child tax credit is a huge deal that has yet to be rolled out, so that people really feel the relief and make the political connection. And I am all for the kind of thing that Trump did, signing the checks, being super direct about who brought you this benefit.
Uh-huh.
It makes a big difference.
It does. Deepak Bhargava, there is so much I could talk to you about for hours here, and hopefully you'll join us again in the not-too-distant future. But before I let you go, I noted your newest book is out today, Immigration Matters, Movements, Visions, and Strategies for a Progressive Future. I suspect some of the ideas that are in that book we've sort of already talked about here. But give us the quick elevator pitch for it, if you will, and also how our discussion today parallels what you discuss in the book.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been in this period for the last 4 years of fighting against all of these harsh policies, families being separated at the border, the Muslim ban, et cetera. The real question for us, though, is not just reversing all the bad stuff Trump did, but a positive, long-term, progressive vision for the role of immigration in American society. That's what the book does, and it relates to our discussion because immigrants are maybe the single greatest asset politically and demographically of progressive politics. They are powering unions all over the country. They are crucial voting blocks. The more immigrant a location, population, a geography has, the more blue it is. So leaning into a big positive agenda for welcoming more immigrants is good on the merits, it's good for the economy, and it's really, really good politics.
Immigration Matters is the name of the book, Movements, Visions, and Strategies for a Progressive Future. And Deepak Bhargava, I suspect that many of these things we've talked about today can also be reflected not just at the federal level, but also on a state-by-state level when it comes to state policies. And even further than down towards the ground, so to speak. Lastly, how do you recommend that voters help move all of this forward? What you're talking about makes a lot of sense, but it seems like, elected officials often don't take these actions unless voters make them do so.
Yeah, the truth is the only thing that will renew, restore, and save our democracy is much more participation by everyday people. So I say to everybody, you've got to be part of an organization. That may be a union or a community group or some kind of other civic organization. And that organization has to be involved in politics, but not just in politics at election time. Politics year-round, engaging with elected officials, making sure that they think about how to expand democracy in all senses of the word. That's how we get ourselves out of this mess.
Yeah, indeed. And that's something that the folks on the right really do understand, and something that Democrats and progressives could certainly take a lesson from. Deepak Bhargava is a distinguished lecturer of urban studies at City University of New York. He's a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and he is the co-editor of the new book, Out Today, Immigration Matters, Movements, Visions, and Strategies for a Progressive Future. We will link to all of that, as well as your article with Dorian T. Warren over at the American Prospect, headlined The Progressive Multiplier, How Democrats Can Defeat Trumpism, from your mouth to God's ears. Deepak, really appreciate you joining us here today. Oh, and people can find you on the Twitters at dbhargava68. Deepak Bhargava, really appreciate you joining us today. Hope to do it again soon.
Thanks, Brad. Really great to be with you.
Thank you, sir. As I said, I could talk to him all day,
yeah,
but I really shouldn't because we have got to. We're already running late for our latest Green News Report. That's coming up next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Okay, no stopping us now.
Nope.
We have to get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
The gap between what we are doing and what actually needs to be done is widening by the second.
New climate targets still not enough to close the emissions gap. Republicans' infrastructure proposal about one-fifth the size of Biden's. Plus,
say goodbye to your burgers. In order to help hit the Biden administration's climate goals, a limit of 4 pounds of red meat per year, or a single average-sized burger every month.
Fox News forced to admit Biden's climate plans do not ban red meat.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
A graphic and a script incorrectly implied that it was part of Biden's plan for dealing with climate change. That is not the case.
The Green News Report would like to apologize. We refer to Fox News as news. That is not the case. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, so Fox News spent all weekend long freaking out about Joe Biden canceling meat.
With maximal outrage.
And it turns out it's not true at all.
Nope.
Who could have guessed it?
But we'll have more on that in a moment. So, jobs and clean energy were the central focus of President Joe Biden's two-day virtual climate summit last week, attended by some 40 world leaders, business executives, labor union heads. Biden pledged to cut U.S. emissions 50% by 2030 under the Paris Climate Agreement and reach net zero emissions by 2050, calling climate action an unprecedented opportunity to create millions of jobs transitioning to clean energy.
And canceling meat.
No. Scientists say it's achievable with existing technology, but it'll be a very heavy lift. A new report by Europe's Climate Action Tracker calculates that even with the new, more ambitious pledges announced by the United States and other countries, it is still not enough to meet the Paris targets. And the world is way off track to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050 to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, unless countries pick up the pace of emissions cuts.
Uh-oh. Or if they cancel meat.
A different study from the European Commission's Joint Research Center finds that there's also a huge discrepancy between what the world's nations say they emit in greenhouse gases each year versus the amount of emissions that independent organizations have calculated using independent models. The gap is roughly equal to the annual emissions of the United States.
Uh-oh.
The researchers warn that the accounting discrepancy will complicate the already difficult task of pinpointing just how much and how fast nations must cut greenhouse gas pollution. Here in the U.S., congressional Republicans unveiled their own infrastructure counterproposal to Biden's American Jobs Plan. Biden proposes to spend $2.2 trillion over 10 years repairing the nation's infrastructure, upgrading for climate impacts, and shifting to cleaner, safer, renewable energy. Republicans' infrastructure proposal is about one-fifth of that, a little over $560 billion.
And I'm guessing there's nothing in it at all about the climate.
Nope.
But they protect burgers, I hope.
Right-wing media began lying about Biden's climate proposals right off the bat, and it demonstrates the right-wing propaganda cycle. They highlighted a year-old, totally unrelated study that suggests that one way to help reduce emissions would be reducing consumption of red meat. The UK's Daily Mail then baselessly speculated that Biden would ban red meat, and then Fox News and right-wing media ran with that lie so Republicans could denounce the imaginary policy. Fox News did not retract that story for 3 days.
Well, you have to have something to be angry about if you're Fox News or Republican.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration is moving quickly. The Environmental Protection Agency and the Transportation Department have both rescinded a Trump-era attempt to strip the state of California of its special authority to set its own vehicle tailpipe emissions and pollution standards. Both agencies announced Monday they will restore California's right to set climate limits on cars and SUVs, which many car makers, like General Motors, have already announced that they're going to shift to all electric vehicles by 2035.
Oh, how nice of them. Instead of Republicans trying to use big government to leverage against small states, the Biden administration is actually letting states do what they please when it comes to limiting carbon emissions.
Finally, Swedish teen climate activist Greta Thunberg testified to the House Oversight Committee on Earth Day. With her characteristic bluntness, Thunberg correctly criticized the pledges made by countries so far as insufficient and delivered a stark warning to those who would delay action.
You still have time to do the right thing and to save your legacies. But that window of time is not going to last for long. We, the young people, are the ones who are going to write about you in the history books. We are the ones who get to decide how you will be remembered. So my advice for you is to choose wisely.
Oh, man. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Choose wisely. This has been your Green News Report.
It's not too late to turn this ship around, to sail into the wind, my love, before we run aground.
Very nice.
It's not too late.
A deep cut from the Monkees.
I know.
I like it. All right, we have to get out. Thank you very much to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Deepak Bhargava from the City University of New York, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always appreciated. It's always an honor. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. All of which is made possible only by those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate to sign up for a monthly donation to help keep us on your public airwaves. I can't thank you enough, those who have done it. I can't beg you enough, those who haven't. You can drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. That is it. Until we meet again, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
It's not too late.